Harry Truman became president after Roosevelt's unexpected death in April 1945. Here, a collection of Truman's Give 'em Hell, Harry speeches on the presidential campaign trail in 1948.
Republicans, you know, are expected to nominate a candidate for president. They're having a lot of trouble deciding on just who that candidate for president will be and for just what he stands. I want to say to you that for the next 4 years, there'll be a Democrat in the White House and you're looking at him.
My duty as president requires that I use every means within my power to get the laws the people need on matters of such importance and urgency. I am therefore calling this Congress back into session on the 26th of July. My friends, if there's any reality behind that Republican platform, we ought to get some action out of the short session of the 80th Congress. They could do this job in 15 days if they want to do it. And they'll still have time to go out and run for office.
Senator Barkley and I will win this election and make these Republicans like it. Don't you forget that.
The decisive battle has arrived. The people are going to have to choose one side or the other. The Democratic Party and I have nothing to conceal. We are proud of our record.
Get the hell, Harry!
All right, I'm doing it.
I had my sandwich and glass of buttermilk and went to bed at 6:30. And along about 12 o'clock, I happened to wake up for some reason, and the radio was turned on the National Broadcasting Company. And Mr. Kelton Bourne was saying, while the president is a million votes ahead in the popular vote, we have yet to hear from him. And we are very sure that when the country vote comes in, Mr. Truman will be defeated by an overwhelming majority. And I went back to bed and went to sleep. About 4 o'clock in the morning, the chief of the Secret Service came in and said, Mr. President, I think you'd better get up and listen to the broadcast. We've been listening all night. And I said, all right. And I turned the darn thing on, and there was Mr. Kelton Bourne again. And then Mr. Harkness came on and analyzed the situation. I called the Secret Service men and I said, we'd better go back to Kansas City. Looks as if I'm elected. Along about 10 o'clock, I got a telegram which said that the election was over and that I should be congratulated on the fact that I had won the election. And apparently, it was too bad, but it happened.
Thank you for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just catching us, we're listening to Carbon Math with Bill McKibben, founder of 350.org, and John Hoffmeister, CEO of Citizens for Affordable Energy and former president of Shell Oil Company. They talk about the current state of energy and technology and the climate and agree that the world needs better energy alternatives, but disagree on when the needed changes will happen.
The world's scientists have made that connection in profound and deep ways. They do it over and over again. There's a story on the front page of the Washington Post today from the National Kevin Trenberth at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration saying, very bad news, that all our the series of new studies on water in the atmosphere showing that we can expect results from global warming to come in at the very top range, the worst estimates of what we've been going on. This just gets worse and worse, and that's why there's this movement starting to build. We managed to have the biggest civil disobedience action in 30 years last year about any issue. 1,253 people who went to jail to stop at least for a while that Keystone pipeline that would have poured as much oil out of the tar sands of Canada as the new automobile mileage regulations would save. No, we can't keep making these trade-offs anymore. We've got to get serious, finally. And that means continuing to build that kind of popular uprising. We just launched at 350.org this 21, if I seem a little groggy, it's because we're doing 21 cities in 21 nights and crossing the country on a biodiesel bus. And it's a lot of fun sleeping in the back of a bus. All my rock star fantasies are diminishing, you know, by the hour. But we've had huge crowds, and the politicians are starting to listen. The mayor of Seattle stood up on stage two nights ago and say, we're figuring out, I'm talking with my treasurer about how we're going to divest our money, city money, from fossil fuel companies. Yesterday, the first college in America to make the decision, they made the announcement yesterday, Unity College in Maine, that they would divest all their portfolio from fossil fuel companies. Because this is a moral issue, like, say, apartheid in South Africa 25 years ago, when 200 colleges did that exact thing and helped bring to an end one of the scourges we faced then. We're showing a piece of film as we go around the country from one of our advisors at 350.org, Desmond Tutu, who won the Nobel Prize for his work on apartheid. And what he says in that is, this is the next great moral challenge that we face. On top of the physical and practical challenge, it is the moral challenge of all time, because what we're doing as we raise the temperature is not just make our own lives hard. If that's all we were doing, we'd be fools, but it would be one thing. What we're doing is making life impossible for the poorest people on the planet, who are grappling this summer with the 40% rise in food prices, and we're making life impossible for everybody who has to come after us on a planet deeply degraded. We've already taken this Earth out of the Holocene. The question is, how far into whatever comes next we're going to go, and that's why we're rising up.
So, John Hofmeister, let's get you on pressuring oil companies' divestiture. Will that have an impact? Is this a moral issue?
I think the moral issue that should be faced first and foremost is to take special interest money out of the American political process. As long as special interest money from any source, from any special interest group, dominates the voice of the people of this country, I think it's an abuse of free speech, which was never imagined by the founders who wrote freedom of speech as a basic right of Americans. There was no such thing as lobbyists and special interests and so forth. And so we have perpetrated upon ourselves as a nation $6 billion spent in the last election to stay even, to make essentially no change. Lowest voter turnout in the last three elections with the issues we face as a country? Because how many people give up when the special interests are buying candidates here or candidates there? So to me, if we're not going to deal with special interest money in the political process, any other kind of conversation is just an academic exercise, because it's the political process. Now, it's fine and it's wonderful for intelligent people to come together and discuss what the scientists know and to try to act on what the scientists know. And I'm not going to argue against the scientists. I'm not qualified to do that. But I would indicate that scientists over the years have not always been correct. And I'm not saying that they're incorrect on this issue of linking carbon in the atmosphere to climate change. But what I am saying is that, to your point, if the activity is directed against a particular industry, as in the case of fossil fuel in the United States, all that will happen in the United States of America is this nation will get poorer, and the rest of the world will have more oil and natural gas. Because we don't run the world in this country. We're a part of the world. We share the world. We perhaps use more than our fair share in the current scheme of things because we're wealthier. But there is no affordable energy mix that can be imagined today and implemented today to achieve the lifestyles that people practice today without carbon energy. It just can't happen, you know, with what we know today.
But Shell and Oil seemed to be giving up by selling its renewable energy portfolio. It's not even trying.
No, I was part of that. I was part of that decision-making process. We were selling to consumers junk technology, and it felt that it was just wrong to do that. Silicon-based photovoltaic cells. What a waste of money, ladies and gentlemen, to get 8 to 9% efficient electricity when the sun shines and to pretend that this is going to take care of your electricity needs. We felt it was just wrong that this technology was outdated. We took all the money from the sale of photovoltaic. We put it into the next generation of technology called thin film, because that would double the efficiency from photovoltaic to thin film. And let's put that money into better technology. I still think thin film is nowhere near what it needs to be to compete with other sources of energy. Shell's still in the wind business because the wind business makes a lot more common sense. And why wouldn't you take advantage of a free source? But we're not going to spend shareholder money on technology that you know doesn't work. That's why. In the case of the Arctic, Bill brought up the Arctic. I was part of that as well. If a company like Shell, which has some of the best technology in the world, doesn't get to help set the standard for Arctic production, knowing that Arctic production will occur because the U.S. Congress or the U.S. country can't stop it, the Russians, the Chinese, other companies will go to the Arctic. There's no way to stop that. If the standard can't be set to protect the environmental risk, and Shell is probably best positioned of any company to set the standard, then let's go do that. Because the world, as we know it, will demand carbon fuel every day from now for the next 30, 40, 50 years. If you look at the gas lines in the aftermath of Sandy in New York, they've had to go to odd-even rationing, and I'm glad they did. I recommended it a week ago on CNBC because the demand is so great. People are tied to their gas tanks. And if we don't find a way to keep those gas tanks full while we find a replacement technology.
You know, we've found a lot of the replacement technology. The German energy minister in the conservative government of Angela Merkel said Monday that Germany was going to blow past their target for renewable energy, that they'd be at 50% by 2025 and nearing, they might be at 66%. They're the one big country that took this seriously, that didn't let the fossil fuel industry stop them from doing things. You're absolutely right that special interest money is the problem, and that special interest money comes from the fossil fuel industry. You know, when you were running Shell, you were a faithful member of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and of the American Petroleum Institute, which are the two biggest sources of this dirty energy money that, you know, it warps, you know, it's not only that carbon warps our atmosphere, it's that that money warps our politics. And we'll get both of them out. I mean, our demand, as we talk about divestment from fossil fuel, is twofold. One, that companies stop lobbying in Washington, so there we're in agreement. And two, I guess, and two, that they stop exploring for new hydrocarbons. I wrote a piece this summer in Rolling Stone that went oddly viral. It was the issue with Justin Bieber on the cover. But the editor said, you know, called me a couple of days later and said, something very strange is happening. Your piece has 10 times more likes on Facebook than Justin Bieber. And the
you can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
And the reason was that it laid out finally the math in a way that people could understand. The one thing that the world has agreed on, every country, including China and the U.S., is that 2 degrees of global warming is too much. It's definitely too much because 1 degree, what we've had so far, melts the Arctic. 2 degrees is way too much, but it's the one thing we've agreed on. We know how much carbon it would take to take us past 2 degrees. We can burn about 550 gigatons more CO2 between now and 2050. But what the article pointed out, and this is new stuff that came from financial analysts around the world, the fossil fuel industry, the Shells of the world, already have in their reserves 2,800 gigatons worth of carbon, five times more than we can burn. Shell, in its reserves alone, has 5% of the carbon necessary to break the planet. One company with one CEO, one board of directors. This is, you know, this is the gravest problem we've ever faced. And all the sort of talk about let's take a long time and figure out all the easiest possible ways to do it and whatever, we're past that. It's time now that we grapple with the fact that it's our generations that will or will not decide how all this comes out. The good news is that the engineers and entrepreneurs, given a chance, will do an awful lot of work. The other good news, and this is a place where I very much agree with John, is that it's going to have to be done globally. That's why 350.org works in 191 countries around the world, every country but North Korea. In India, on Saturday, we're having a huge Quit Coal India Day. On Saturday, across the Arab world, we're working with the Arab Youth Climate Movement on a huge series of rallies and demonstrations. We've had about 20,000 of these in the last 4 years all around the world. It's a big, growing movement, and it's starting to bite the year-long delay in the Keystone Pipeline, and we'll see what happens now that the president's been reelected, was something that nobody in the fossil fuel industry expected, and they spent a lot of money trying to make sure that that thing would go through as planned. But people started getting in the way. And people are going to start getting in the way in a lot of places the more they see things like Sandy, and the more they realize, stranded after Sandy, that they'd be a hell of a lot better off instead of waiting in gas lines with a good, dispersed, diffuse, renewable energy network where, you know, their electric car was running off the solar panel on their roof. That's completely possible. That's how, you know, my house roof is covered with solar panels, and I can plug in the plug-in hybrid to run right off it. That's what the future of the world looks like, and it's not endlessly far off. You can go to the Ford GM dealership today and come home with a car that you can run off the sun, and it works just as well as anybody else's car.
Let me remind... If you're just joining us, our guests today at Climate One are Bill McKibben, founder of 350.org, and John Hofmeister, former president of Shell Oil Company and CEO of Americans for Affordable Energy. John Hofmeister, Shell used to be heavily invested in coal and it exited coal. Why?
In the late 1990s, I would submit that Royal Dutch Shell as a company was, in a sense, ahead of its time relative to its competitors in looking at the global effects of fossil fuel, and decided that to put more shareholder money investing into coal, with all the obstacles that coal would face as time moved on, was not a good use of the money. And so it determined to divest itself of coal, let others who prefer to fight that complexity have at the assets. And then in 1998, Shell decided in its strategic outlook on the future to move away from oil and towards natural gas, without making a big public splash in either case, on the reality that let's not promise what we can't deliver. Let's not build an expectation that isn't realistic. Because for as long as anyone sitting around that table, when I was sitting around that table back then, said, look, we'll all be dead and we're still going to be using fossil fuels. Let me tell you how hard the alternative is. Next Thursday, I convene as the chairman of the Department of Energy's Hydrogen Technology Advisory Committee, our last meeting of the year. We're going to review the National Petroleum Industry's report out from last August that looks at the future, as requested by Secretary Chu, that looks at the future of transportation fuels and the opportunity to reduce greenhouse gases by 50% by 2050. The National Petroleum Council conclusion, looking at all of the objectives, looking at all of the possibilities, looking at all fuels, including electrification of transportation.
Although that report really did soft-pedal electric cars. It didn't look at it that seriously.
But it made the point, and that Secretary Chu actually toughened the requirement, what will it take to go to 50% lower greenhouse gases? They couldn't get there by 2050. Now, you could argue they weren't aggressive enough. But I'm sitting there.
Some groups left that obviously study because it wasn't aggressive.
But I'm sitting there with this committee. I'm now the chairman. They elected me as the chairman. We're facing an administration that has cut back on the spending for hydrogen fuel cell technology from the prior administration. The administration actually zeroed the budget for hydrogen fuel cell technology for transportation when it first came into office. Congress reinstated it. We have a group of dedicated volunteers. We're all special government employees, which means we're government employees and we don't get paid. It's a special category. We're volunteers. But the resistance is not just an industry. The resistance is the bureaucracy. The resistance is the politics.
Well, in that case, Secretary Chu believes that hydrogen is not a very promising form of energy. It takes a lot of energy to generate hydrogen, and we can debate hydrogen. But what I wanted to get at with that coal example was that Shell exited coal because it saw it as a loser of a business, and it's moving away from oil to gas. Do you think Shell will ever exit oil? Does it see the horizons for oil also diminishing or facing more social resistance because of climate change?
Well, if you stand back and look at all of the literature across the industry when it comes to transportation, the world's headed for 2 billion cars. How much percentage of those cars will be based on internal combustion engines that fundamentally only use gasoline? Unless we find an alternative to gasoline, unless we find an alternative to petroleum-based fuel, I think we're stuck with growing demand of oil over the next 25 years, not reducing the demand. Unless we could find a substitute. Now, I'm on the Energy Security Council, which is a group of some 25 former presidential appointees and a few business leaders, and our advocacy is to take natural gas, half the carbon of oil, and make methanol from natural gas, which with flex fuel internal combustion engines can displace significant amount of oil and have a more favorable environmental impact at the same time. The methanol opportunity is huge with all the natural gas we have in this country. We're pursuing it. I was on the phone this morning. How do we build the kind of reformer units across the country that could supply methanol as an alternative? But we need flex fuel engines.
Let's get Bill McKibben's. Natural gas is seen by some people as a promise, as a bridge. It's American. It's cleaner. Is that a good step to make?
Well, there are two huge problems. One is we say it's cleaner because you produce less carbon when you burn it. The trouble is natural gas is CH4, methane. It's molecule for molecule 25 times more potent greenhouse gas. So do the math. If 2% leaks out in the course of the process, then it's dirtier than coal. The only study we really have of how much leaks out was in Science in January, the big gas field in Colorado, and it was finding 4% leakage rates. So that's one problem. The other problem is, and this is exemplified by this plan to do a lot of natural gas vehicles and things, it undercuts the transition to gas, undercuts renewables more quickly even than it undercuts coal. The IEA, the International Energy Agency, modeled what happened with a world that converted very quickly to gas, got off everything else. And that world, because renewables get aced out of the picture, that world is 660 parts per million CO2, and the temperature goes up 3.5 degrees Celsius, twice as much almost as the most conservative government on Earth says would be safe. Our job is not to figure out how to, you know, keep the fossil fuel industry going with some other, you know, fossil fuel that's a little marginally better. Our job is to figure out how to provide the energy that people need in ways that will allow the planet to keep working. So, to the degree that we have to have cars, and, you know, there are lots of other things we can substitute in lots of places, like, say, trains and bicycles and feet. But to the extent that we continue to have cars, well, the clear answer is to electrify them and to get the electricity from renewable sources. It's entirely doable. It's not cheap to do, but we've got to start figuring out what real cost economics looks like. You know, the one good set of estimates we have about what the economic impact of global warming will be from the Stern report in the UK a few years ago was that it might add up to 20% of the planet's GDP by the end of the century. I don't know what the number is for Shell. You could probably tell us, but Exxon boasts about spending $100 million a day looking for new hydrocarbons, even though we already have five times more than anybody says we can safely burn. Think what $100 million a day from just one company would do spent on solar panels. Think how quickly we'd be rolling this out.
Bill McKibben mentioned electric cars. John, you know the book by Steve Cole, Pulitzer Prize winning author, on ExxonMobil, Private Empire. And in there, he writes that the one thing that ExxonMobil worried about was a breakthrough in battery technology. That could really threaten their business model and their profits. And what do you think about a breakthrough in battery technology in electric cars?
Well, I've already stated my position on internal combustion engines. And so I pray for a breakthrough, because I think Bill and I actually agree in the end game. We just don't agree with how quickly we can get there. And I'm a pragmatist in that regard, not a theorist. And so I think that the breakthrough in battery technology is still elusive. We watched 300 Fisker cars in the port of New Jersey get flooded, and about a dozen of them caught fire in the midst of a flood. That's not going to do a lot for Fisker's reputation. The battery technology of today is just not going to get us there as a mass market vehicle. Niche vehicle, fine. Those who can afford it.
Good evening, good evening. I am a reporter for Al Jazeera, the Arab News Network. And I am here this evening to dispel the ugly rumors that our broadcast contains secret messages intended for terrorists. That is not true. Our broadcasts are straight, just like your Fox TV. No, it's not true. We Arabs, we love your people. We love the USA. It is true. I have a little song to sing for you that will prove that. But first, I'd like to introduce my special assistant, Falala Smith. That's her married name. Yes, she is the winner of the Al Jazeera Wet Burqa Contest. She has a lovely figure. Trust me on this. All right, shall we begin? Al Jazeera, jolly Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera, love the USA. You sing along with me now. Yes, you know this tune, eh? It's an old Arab tune. Here we go. Al Jazeera, jolly Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera loves the USA. Afghan president is calm. Hope we don't see Karzai bomb. Karzai bomb! Karzai bomb! Oh, sing along. Al Jazeera, jolly Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera loves the president. We're in Cuban prison cells, locked in yours, not infidels. Infidels! Karzai bomb! Here we go again. Al Jazeera, jolly Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera loves the USA. Arab views are not so mean. That's how views in Gaza lean. In gasoline! Infidels! Karzai bomb! Here we go again. Al Jazeera, jolly Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera loves the USA. For Iraq's rebuilding path, pick a leader, take a bath. Take a bath in gasoline. Infidels, Karzai bomb. Jazeera, jolly Al Jazeera, Al Jazeera loves the USA. Salam, salam, salam.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.